wow, how arrogant to claim grief as human. So that in order for that to be anthropomorphism, you have to be willing to say, we own grief. It's ours. It's human. It doesn't belong to anybody else on this whole earth. And my answer to that is just no.
Hi, I'm Elizabeth Novogratz. Welcome to Species Unite, the podcast where we talk to people who are fighting some of the hardest fights on Earth to stop the unnecessary suffering of animals. Today's conversation is with one of the coolest scientists I've ever met. Barbara King is a biological anthropologist, and she focuses on how the science of animal thinking can help us better advocate for the rights of animals. She studied the complex emotions throughout the animal kingdom, from orcas to elephants to ducks to dogs, with a focus on grief and love. She's also an emerita professor at the College of William and Mary. She's written several books, including How Animals Grieve and Personalities on the Plate. She gave an incredible TED Talk this year, which has already been seen by more than 1.5 million people. What I'd like to do is start with your work and go way back to when you first started out. I'm curious for a million reasons, but one reason I'm really curious is because I was an anthropology major and a huge animal lover. But it didn't really ever occur to me, animals and anthropology. Was I just completely daft or?
Not at all. It didn't occur to me in any way until my junior year of college. I stumbled into a biological anthropology class that featured a big section on monkey and ape behavior. And the sky cracked open for me because it was a revelation. I had been in pre-med classes. They were not going well. For the first time, I was getting horrendous grades. I was restless and unhappy. And suddenly I realized that it's possible to make a career with animals in a different way than I had conceived of before. Observing our closest living relatives in a variety of contexts, making sense of what they're doing and applying it to our lives. And I was hooked right there.
So what happened? So you graduate and then what?
Well, I graduated from Douglas College and finally realized, yes, I need to be in graduate school for this. And I went out to the University of Oklahoma and I did some work there on captive chimpanzees, but my heart was set on going into the wild to study apes. I wrote a grant to the National Science Foundation to go study mountain gorillas at Diane Fossey's site. And she did welcome this. Unfortunately, I was in Gabon earning money in West Africa to be able to go on and do the study in addition to National Science Foundation funds in East Africa when I got a letter from the government of Rwanda saying that I would not be allowed to do my work. They felt that it was not conservation-oriented enough, and they denied me entry. So there I was sitting in West Africa thinking that I was about to do my dissertation work and went home, rewrote the entire grant proposal, ended up in Kenya studying baboons. And I'm very happy to this day. And I wouldn't change a thing at the time, of course. It felt like a series of continual disasters. It's not always a straight linear trajectory to get to do what you want. Things happen.
And often our best opportunities are what look like complete crises and mishaps.
For sure.
And so you studied baboons.
Yeah.
Where'd you go from there?
I learned that it was important to write a book. And at the same time, over the next years, two other things happened. I started to fall in love with lots of different types of animals. You know, I'd been trained in our closest living relatives, monkeys and apes. I had been in Kenya. I'd been doing captive work in different locations in the U.S. on gestural communication of gorillas and bonobos. And that was all wonderful. But I started to think, maybe it's not all just primates. You know, I was really trained to think that primates were at the top of the heap cognitively and emotionally. They're the closest to us. They're the most like us, therefore the smartest and the most profound at feeling. And I started to really question that and to look at other animals. And the second thing that happened was I became convinced I wanted to write for the public instead of just for other scientists. What I wanted to do was rigorous science-based storytelling about animal cognition and emotion with a net cast really wide, thinking about a lot of different animals.
Your books feel more like storytelling than science. They're page turners in the sense of just it's incredible story after incredible story. When did animals' emotional lives enter the picture?
My wheelhouse was animal cognition for a long time. Then life took an interesting turn when a publisher called and asked if I wanted to write a book on the origins of religion and human evolution. And part of that was about the origin of burials and whether or not that relates to the origins of religion. But along the way, when I was reading about Neanderthal burials and early Homo sapiens burials, I started thinking about animals and death and how animals may process death of those close to them. How might they express visible emotion around that, if at all? And so I started a new project that led eventually to a book called How Animals Grieve that I wrote 6 years ago. That was a life changer for me because I learned so much in the research about the number of different types of animals who do express emotion around death. And it led me to shift to thinking about emotional lives of animals.
That's your TED Talk, Animals and Grief. And that's what I want to talk about next. Let's start from your talk is Tahlequah, the whale that we all watched carry her dead baby around for 17 days. To start, is this something whales do or has anyone seen this before?
Yes. So this, as you mentioned, happened in the summer of 2018. And there's lots of really good examples from scientists who have watched mother whales keeping their dead babies afloat or other pod behaviors surrounding a dead companion and acting in different and interesting ways around that death that seem to me to show an expression of emotion. And then Tahlequah enters the scene. And as you said, for 17 days, there's this unfolding story of a mammalian mother who refuses to let her dead calf fall off her body into the water. So she swims with the J-pod, which is in the waters off of British Columbia and Washington State. This is a very well-known group of whales to scientists. And scientists had hoped that this particular calf would live because it had been 3 years since the calf had lived in the pod, but the calf died within hours. And then Tahlequah, 17 days, kept that baby with her. This whale is swimming for 1,000 miles. The body falls off into the water on occasion, and she dives, and she retrieves the body. There are times when she can keep up with her pod. There are times when she cannot. She's putting incredible energy, determination, and commitment into doing this.
How does the body even stay on the whale?
Because she balances it on her body and then keeps it in a way that it is intact. So this is through her behavior and her commitment. And the question that the media started asking, you know, there's day 3 and day 5 and day 7. How long is this going to go on? What does this mean? It fit my definition of grief. In my definition of grief, a surviving animal behaves markedly differently in some way, with some social withdrawal or refusal to eat and sleep. And all of these criteria I felt were met by Tahlequah because of the intensity of what she was doing, the persistence of what she was doing. And then again, the context that we have. These are incredibly smart animals. There was no way, for example, that she would be somehow unaware that her baby had died. I believe it's quite the opposite. It's intense attunement to what happened to her calf.
And were people saying that? Were they saying she doesn't know, she's not aware? Were there naysayers to the grief?
Most definitely. There are always naysayers. Of course, many scientists on site describing this behavior were using emotional terms, were saying this is some type of not just stress, but apparent grief. There were others who were saying, wait a minute, we have to be cautious. Perhaps this is stress. We know that this is a stressed group of animals. And then would say it's anthropomorphic to suggest that it's grief. And we know the definition of anthropomorphism is the attribution of human qualities to other animals. So the suggestion in that case was, oh, look, we might feel grief in that situation, but it's mere projection to say that Tahlequah felt grief. And my response to that is, wow, how arrogant to claim grief as human. So that in order for that to be anthropomorphism, you have to be willing to say, we own grief. It's ours. It's human. It doesn't belong to anybody else on this whole earth. And my answer to that is just no.
You've seen this trajectory with anthropomorphism because you've been in this for a long time. Mm-hmm. And slowly, I feel like over time, and especially now, it's becoming much more embedded into science. People are really taking them seriously. But is there still a big resistance? How does that actually look from someone who's in its mm-hmm. perspective?
I'd like to go back a little further because we know that Charles Darwin in the 19th century was full proponent of studying animal emotion. So there has been a reanimation of these questions, but they're by no means new. He talked about sadness and joy, jealousy in a number of animals, from orangutans to dogs. So he was, as usual, way ahead of his time. But then in the 1950s, Japanese scientists went out to study wild monkeys and started talking about society and culture. Jane Goodall, of course, began her field work with chimpanzees in Africa, and a number of other scientists began to think more deeply about questions of thinking and emotion both. So yes, there's been a tsunami of more interest, but there's also pushback. Some scientists are very much on board with looking at animal emotion, and others really do suggest that, for example, there may be a bodily state of fear or maybe even joy in an animal, but that we can't know it's actually consciously processed by that animal. In other words, the animal may be unaware of his or her own bodily state. So there's a very common distinction, for example, in neuroscience, between an emotion, which is a certain flooded sort of hormonal state in the body, and feeling, which is the mental awareness of the emotion. And that is an interesting distinction, but the animals that I'm talking about are clearly conscious.
Well, even if you look at a dog who's really happy, I mean, that would be saying that you come home, your dog's really happy to see you. Clearly, dog owners are aware that their dog's happy. And they'd be saying, oh, the dog is actually just like spontaneously reacting to some stimuli, but it doesn't actually know that it's feeling happiness.
That we can't know if the dog knows, and that we therefore have to be incredibly careful about the conclusions we draw. And the distinction between emotion and feeling that I've just described is not one that I carry through in my work, because I see a wide range of mammals and birds, and in some cases, reptiles, etc., to be conscious, able to reflect to some degree on what's happening in their own world. So my basic stance is that, you know, animals have good days and bad days like we do, but not every single animal. So I do want to be careful about credibility. I recently read in two different manuscripts that I was reviewing, citation of my work with the conclusion that all animals grieve. And surely that's not correct either. We don't want to make that leap either. 90% of the animals on the earth, isn't it, are invertebrates, and some of them may grieve, but we don't want to go around saying that mosquitoes grieve and every species of fish grieve. We don't know that, and we would not expect that necessarily. So I think it's incredibly important for questions to be raised and even doubts to be raised. But there's a difference between good, rigorous science that proceeds by thinking of alternatives and questioning and doubt from that firewall of human exceptionalism that I was talking about earlier. And that firewall is the thing that tells us, oh no, it can't possibly be as profound an emotional experience in an orca or a dog because they're not human. A priori, the answer is, you know, just clear to these folks. And I just don't see that.
Let's go back to these animals that you talk about in your talk first, the elephant and what elephants do when someone in their family dies. And you tell this beautiful story and that elephants really mourn. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yes, there are many examples. And the one that I talk about for my TED talk involves Eleanor, who is an elephant who collapsed in Kenya one day, and two matriarchs, two females from other families, responded very profoundly to this. One tried to raise her up on her feet, and she did collapse and die. And these females, one really kept a vigil at the body. Another was kind of raising their feet around the body in ways that suggest both exploration and distress. And for the next week, there were elephants that came to the body over and over, and they showed a range of responses. So my claim is not that every elephant who came showed grief, but I think more stringently and with more credibility, some wanted to explore and were just curious, but others showed external cues of elephant grief, just profound distress, not wanting to leave, you know, acting in elephant ways that show sadness.
You've mentioned birds a few times. Mm-hmm. Can you give a story of birds and grief?
Well, I think the work of Bernd Heinrich is really helpful because he talks about different types of geese. And we know that these are among the bird species where partners may mate for life. And so he tells stories of a mate disappearing and the other, the male or female, whoever is left behind as the survivor, just flying and searching and, you know, crying out, looking for that mate. It's not as if these birds are interchangeable one for the other, which we sometimes think about birds. You know, if there's a disappearance of one, well, they'll just find another. Well, of course, that's incredibly an arrogant view. And he talks about individuals he's known who continue for days to search for their mate and then go into a period of social withdrawal and evident sadness. And of course, many birds, like many mammals and many, including many humans, have resilience and they may recover. But that period of mourning is very, very clear.
When your books come out and people discover you for the first time, or they hear your TED Talk and it's the first time they discover you, there is part of the world that's saying, well, we all knew that. We're dog people. Do you get a lot of animal people like sharing stories and saying, hey, here's my example?
Oh, yes. And in fact, you know, the TED Talk was remarkable in this way for me, because my books have had a certain reach to public audiences, but with TED, it's a different level, which is just amazing for me. And the letters started coming, emailed to me. There were people in Virginia writing to me about horses and pigs. Oh, there was someone who wrote about sheep, you know, examples that they had seen, sheep, horses, pigs, where they knew that grieving had occurred. And of course, because I'm trained in science, I would ask questions and I would say, you know, well, what did you see exactly? And, you know, was it this or was it that? But these people know in many cases exactly what they're seeing. And so there's always this tension for me because, you know, I get a little unhappy when people say, oh, we don't even have to really look at that. We know this. We're animal people. Well, science does need to look at this. That's what science is about. It's about rigor and asking for alternatives and making sure that we're on the right track. But I also give full credit to people in animal sanctuaries, in some cases, zoos, many domestic situations, farms, who can just say to me, look, I get what you're saying because I've seen it.
So why grief of all the emotions as the one to really focus on?
You know, that's an interesting question that I've asked myself. If you walk into my home, there's lots of bookcases, and one of them has a huge area devoted to the grief genre of books written by people who have experienced grief. So someone who lost a child, a husband, a wife, someone important to them. And for some reason that I can't even really explain to you, this genre of book just fascinates me. And the idea that there is this knife edge of love and grief so evident throughout all our days as humans, because we realize that life is finite, that we share some of that with other animals. There's so many other animals who have an experience on this earth where they love in some way and then they lose someone. And there's something about that dynamic that just interests me more than any other emotion. But as you can see, it's wrapped up with other emotions. Because if you feel joy with another individual and love in some way, or are deeply friendly with that other individual, then that grief is going to be sharp. So I think for me, it's an umbrella. You think about grief and then you're kicked into thinking about other emotions.
Well, and you need these other emotions first for in order to feel grief. When you first started, did you go in thinking all animals feel grief, or did you go in assuming kind of one by one, like, okay, we saw the foie gras ducks, or we saw...
It was very gradual. You know, there's always, I think, a part of me from that anthropology graduate school training that always expects the primates, monkeys and apes, to be somehow, you know, more of, better at. So I thought, this is going to be really fun because I can really get into the literature on monkeys and apes and dolphins and whales and elephants, and then let's see. But my mind was kind of blown because there's some things that just have happened. I got a picture over email one day of a donkey standing on the grave of a horse. So this came from a very fine animal sanctuary in Alberta, Canada. And people wrote me and said, you know, we have one donkey here named Lena, and she took a while to bond with anyone because there are no other donkeys, but she did finally bond with an elderly horse named Jake. And for 3 years, they were fast friends. But Jake had to be put down. He was in his 30s. He was old. And that was the humane thing to do. So the sanctuary workers put him in the field in a grave, and Lena, the donkey, went out there and stood on it. And it is a picture where there's a lone animal on a grave from a long lens with a kind of snowy landscape. And I just look at it and I think, this is a donkey. And why did I not expect that? And I should have. The donkey who's feeling something, who does not want to come into the barn, who is socially withdrawn, who doesn't care about eating or drinking, enough so for these experienced animal people to write me and say, can you think with us about how to help Lena? And we did that, and she did eventually recover. And again, do we normally think of farm animals that way? And this is a very big divide for me in the world of animal emotions. The excitement that people feel when they learn something new about how an ape might feel or an elephant might feel, it seems to kind of hit a wall when it comes to farmed animals. And I'm very interested in thinking about why that might be the case, why we might not expect the emotion to exist, or why we might be resistant to hearing about it. I've mentioned my book, How Animals Grieve. My more recent book is about the lives and minds of animals we eat, Personalities on the Plate. And the response to that one has been very different. People tell me it's painful. They don't necessarily want to know about the lives of the animals they eat. And there's a resistance there that I did not encounter with writing about animal grief in some of the wildlife that I've talked about. We want chimpanzees and elephants and dolphins to be really smart, but we don't want, quote unquote, food animals to be smart. We'd rather they be stupid. They're not, but it makes it easier. Now, I have to say that researching these two books has caused a revolution in who I don't eat. I couldn't find out these things and keep eating the way that I did. And that's been a really profound personal journey for me, that I started out as the traditional animal-loving omnivore, and that is not where I've ended up.
Where are you now?
I'm on the reducitarian continuum.
I love that word.
A word that I really love, and all kudos to Brian Kateman and Tyler Alterman for coming up with it. I'm nestled fairly close to the vegan end of it. I have some really fairly complicated and entangled medical health things going on. So I am not vegan. I'm close to vegan. And that's a distinction that I want to be honest about. But my refrigerator, my husband's and mine, is full of non-dairy stuff now, because the last bit for me really was learning, okay, I haven't eaten meat for a pretty good number of years now. But it's been much more recently, I'm a bit embarrassed to say, that I realized why dairy products should go on my no thank you list. And so I'm now a big proponent of non-dairy cheese and milk and ice cream and yogurt, and find it delicious and find it important. Because of course, if you're going to talk about grief in farmed animals, dairy cows are right up there. Dairy cows, of course, are kept continuously pregnant so that we humans can take the milk, and that means their offspring are removed from them repeatedly over and over. So if you go to a farm sanctuary and you find cows there who are able to keep their offspring, it's like the cows are beside themselves because they've never, if they've been in the industry, they've never had this experience before. And sanctuary workers have told me that if it's, say, the fifth birth, but the first one that they can keep, the cows are very protective because they expect their offspring to be taken from them as they always had been. So that incredibly close connection between the slaughterhouses that I thought I was avoiding by not eating meat and, you know, the dairy industry that I now realize is very complicit, you know, is what compelled me to rethink.
Well, I think for me, it's similar. I was vegetarian since I was a kid because I loved animals. I've only been vegan 4 years. And it's not that it didn't occur to me. Of course, I knew. But something in me didn't know or didn't want to know. And it might have been as ridiculous as my love of cheese. And, you know, the minute I gave up cheese, I honestly didn't think about it. And vegan cheese has gotten all the
so
vegan,
much
all the non-dairy stuff.
Yeah.
And it's a very lucky time to be vegan because the food's so good.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's actually great that you're on this podcast saying I'm almost fully vegan, but not 100%. Because I think the reducitarian philosophy is welcoming in a lot of ways. For someone to say, hey, I've been eating this way and I'm not there, but it's great, I think has a lot of power in a lot of ways. And I think some people are much more willing to explore when it's coming from that angle.
I am encouraged. And at the same time, one of the animals that I've come to love so much is the octopus. And I've written about octopus in a number of ways in my book, but also essays. But I'm so concerned to see that there's now an attempt to replicate essentially factory farm conditions for octopus in aquaculture. So part of what I'm trying to do, I think, is even expand our definition of what a farmed animal is, because we know that octopus are so smart. We don't know a lot about their emotions, but we know they have moods because they flash them on their skin from their chromatophores. And you could just see by their color changes, their engagement, their excitement.
Will you give us an example or tell us a story about their intelligence?
One of the coolest things I've seen is from a David Attenborough program, and there is a shark approaching an octopus, and it looks like it's going to go really badly for the octopus. But then the octopus turns and jams some of his or her arms into the gills of the shark. Now, this cannot be an instinct. This has to be a moment to stop and think and figure out, how do I get myself out of this bad situation? So the shark now has a decision, which is either stay there, try to eat the octopus and suffocate, or let go and swim off. And this shark swims off, and the octopus has reasoned herself or himself out of this problem. And I just think that's amazing. When I went to the New England Aquarium in Boston, I was invited by Cy Montgomery, who's written Soul of an Octopus, to do some behind-the-scenes enrichment with an octopus. So this was not on view with the public, but this was just because the people there, the aquarists there, feel that the octopus benefit from interaction with people. And I got to meet a giant Pacific octopus named the Professor, who came to taste me. I had no fish. I wasn't in any way rewarding him. He was curious as another living being. And when I realized that these arms entwining around mine were a brain entwined with my arm. You know, I'd written for years about the distributed brain, and here there was one around me. It was just an amazing encounter. And I think about that a lot.
At the end of your TED Talk, which I loved so much, so you got three big, huge rounds of applause. As you said, three lines, one about the orcas, one about the elephants,
One about chimpanzees.
And one about chimpanzees. And the more we know about each of these animals on the science end, the more on the human side, we'll start protecting them by not going to SeaWorld or giving money to those kind of places and not going to circuses. Mm-hmm. My response to watching this and hearing all that applause was, holy moly, you know, everybody was engaged and excited. about not doing these things. And so can you talk a little more about that and about how much science affects the culture in terms of how we treat animals from those three things, but also food?
I want to start by saying that the whole process of giving a TED Talk was just so amazing. And this does relate to your question.
Okay.
Right before you go on, you're in this little corridor behind the stage and they kind of, you know, make sure your mic is there and your hair is ready and everything. And, you know, everybody had been giving me advice about everything, of how to practice, how to put my feet down, how to look confident. No one had ever talked about the possibility that there'd be applause during the talk. It had never seriously occurred to me. So I think I looked a little bit like a deer in the headlights when that happened because I didn't expect it. I had said, let's open the tanks at SeaWorld. We know orcas grieve. Let's not keep them captive. Let's fight hard against elephant poaching because we know they grieve. Let's not keep chimpanzees and monkeys in invasive biomedical laboratories because we know how profoundly they feel their lives. Let's connect the dots to who we eat. It's not only the ducks and the cows, but it's also the pigs and the chickens who feel their lives. And I did feel that the audience was with me, that they were ready to bring the anecdote and storytelling part of the talk to a conclusion that relates to us. If we know that animals profoundly think and feel, okay, great, we know it, but now what? So the science, for me, needs to compel us to that next step. What specifically do we do? And of course, when it comes to food, it's easy because three times a day we have a choice to make. I do want to say, for every person out there who's turned on by the science of animal thinking and feeling, that is so cool. That's great. But let's together go to the next level and let's think about how we can use what we know to change our behavior, whether it's at SeaWorld or fighting against science labs or fighting for wildlife or not eating animals.
That's awesome. Seriously, when you were just kind of hashing the end of the TED Talk, I got chills all over again.
Oh,
that was so good. That's really amazing because it just keeps spreading this message, which is so powerful, and it's time.
I agree. The animals are waiting.
Thank you, Barbara.
Thank you, Beth.
If you want to go deeper into the worlds of animal cognition and learn more about their emotional lives, go to Barbara's website. It's barbarajking.com. There are links to her work and her TED Talk on our website, speciesunite.com. We're also on Facebook and Instagram at Species Unite. And if you'd like to support the podcast, one way in which you can is to subscribe, rate, and review on Apple Podcasts. And we're also on Patreon. It's patreon.com/speciesunite. Thank you for listening. I'd like to thank everyone who made today's episode possible, including Gary Knudsen, Natalie Martin, Allison Berenger, and Anna Kollner, who wrote and performed today's music. Thanks again. Have a wonderful day.